This sermon was delivered at Grand Avenue Baptist Church, a gospel-centered church in Ames, Iowa. Hear more sermons and learn more about Grand Avenue at gabcames.org.
Let's go ahead and get started here. So welcome back to Foundations. Excited to get rolling and looking forward to this for a while. We did apologetics last semester. Back in the spring. And so, but before that, we did the Old Testament. And so today, we're going to be starting our New Testament series. If you would like to go and check out some of the old lessons, they're on our website, but they're also on our podcast that we have for our Sunday school. It's called Beyond Foundations. This Sunday school is called Foundations, so you can put two and two together there. So that podcast, if you're looking for it, if you want to go find those Old Testament lectures, you can find those on there. Let me know if you're having a hard time finding it. I can point you in that direction. So this one, like I said, we'll be starting the New Testament. Before we get going, let's see, college students, who here is new to Grand or new to Iowa State this year? Okay. Great. Now, who here is a college student who is a member? Could you raise your hand? Okay, great. So one of the things we really value as a church is membership, and so we highly encourage you to pursue that, to look into that. If you have questions about what that means, what that looks like, the process of that, talk to one of those folks who raised their hand, or myself would be happy to do that as well. It's something we value here. For the men, we do on campus on Tuesday nights at 9 o'clock, we do a like men's discussion that really just ranges all over the place. We talked about dating, we talked about marriage, we talked about polygamy, and that was the first week. We even talked about metaphysics, we talked about the Trinity, you know, we talked about the law, we talked about Ten Commandments. Like, we were all over the place. And it really is just like, bring your questions and we're gonna dig into it, see what the Word has to say. See, we talk a lot about history. So let me know if you want to get in touch to be at that. Come, just let me know. It's been on in one of the dorms historically, and we will add you to the little group chat that we do for that. Okay, the announcements out of the way. Let's jump into this. So, introduction to the New Testament. Let me read. You should have this quote on the front. So what I'm going to do today: review the Old Testament. Talk a little bit about what's called the intertestamental period, right? So that period of time between the close of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. We'll talk just a little bit about kind of the changes in the kind of socio-political religious environment from the end of Malachi to the beginning of Matthew. Talk about that a little bit. And then do a brief kind of survey of what we're going to be looking at ahead. Got a lot to cover. So let's jump in. I'm going to go pretty quick over this. We're not going to go super in depth into many of these things. So this should cruise a little bit. So let me just start with a review of the Old Testament. Some of the major themes that we saw in the Old Testament. One of the major we saw God, gospel, and godliness were kind of the three major themes that we teased out of the Old Testament. What the Old Testament is teaching us about these things. So let me read to you just a quote from B.B. Warfield about what the Old Testament teaches about God. So he says, throughout the whole of Old Testament literature, and for every period of history recorded in it, the fundamental conception of God remains the same. And the two most persistently emphasized elements in it are just those of might, that's your first blank, and personality. Might and personality. Before everything else, the God of Israel is the omnipotent person. Omnipotent person. Among everything else that the Old Testament says about God, this is the central message of who God is, of what God is, powerful, personal. I talked about this somewhat recently. I don't remember if it was a sermon or something else. Just about the importance of how various cultures throughout history have understood, went back and forth, but trying to figure out whether or not the ultimate principle of the cosmos was personality or was power. Was a personal thing like the pagans where you know the weather is dependent on the pleasure of the gods, or was some kind of abstract force like the Greek philosophers, the good in an abstract sense. It was biblical religion, God's revealed truth, that first thrust upon us the co-equality, the co-ultimacy of personality and power, of personality and the absolute. And this starts in the Old Testament. Okay, we see this is shown in the Old Testament. It is taught and demonstrated. Those are the two heading blanks there. And then here's a few verses for you. It's taught in that Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. You see this personal, God created. It wasn't something that happened. It wasn't just an outflow. It was a decision, an act of the will of God who created everything, personality and power. Isaiah 41, verse 4, I, the Lord, the first, and with the last, I am he. Right? He's before all things. He is after all things. Numbers 23, 19, God is not man that he should lie, or a son of man that he should change his mind. And notice that it's both the moral aspect, he doesn't lie, but also just kind of an aspect of his being. He's not like us. He doesn't even change his mind. We learn, we make new decisions, we change. God's mind doesn't operate like that. God is absolute. Isaiah 46, 9 and 10, I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will accomplish all my purpose. Okay, so this absoluteness of God is taught, it's demonstrated. We see this in the big historical sweeps of the Old Testament. Creation, I kind of have some comments there you can read in your own time. Creation, the flood, the exodus, the conquest, the exile, where God judges his own people and sends them into captivity in Babylon, the return from exile, where God just kind of pulls them out and puts them back. Right? This is God demonstrating his absolute power, his absolute uniqueness. Okay, the Old Testament teaches us a lot about the gospel. The Old Testament teaches us a tremendous amount about the gospel. Let's see, the three headings that you have there, two of them are blanks, are promises, prefigures, and patterns. Promises, prefigures, and patterns. So in the Old Testament, we see promises about the gospel. Genesis 3:15, I will put enmity, when he's cursing the serpent, I'll put enmity between you, serpent, and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He, this offspring, shall bruise your head, you shall bruise his heel. This is the first kind of promise of the cross. Genesis 12:3, I will bless, talking to Abraham, I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Paul in Galatians looks back on this and says, God preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying all the families of the earth will be blessed. We see details about who Jesus is going to be, about how this gospel is going to be effectuated, how it's going to come to pass. We see that the Old Testament teaches us to expect a prophet. Deuteronomy 18, verse 15, Moses says, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers. It's to him you shall listen. And then he goes on to specify, and this is really interesting, he goes on to specify, just like that one time at the mountain, when the mountain was shaking with fire and you didn't want to deal with God face to face, and so he gave me the Mosaic Covenant. Doesn't use exactly those terms. That's what he's saying, is that just like I gave you this absolute, this covenant for how you're to deal with God, so there's going to be a prophet like me. And every prophet in the Old Testament after Moses recognizes that I'm a prophet, but not the prophet. Elijah has suspicions that it might be him, but God tells him it's not. Get into that some other time. That's the whole mountain thing with the still small voice. A prophet, a priest, Zechariah 3, the verses 8 through 9. This is so interesting. One of the minor prophets. Hear now, O Joshua the high priest. The whole chapter is worth reading. It's really rich. Hear now, O Joshua the high priest, you and your friends who sit before you, for they are men who are a sign. You and your friends, not your buddies, right? The other priests. Joshua, you the high priest, and the other priests, they're a sign. They point to something. They point to something beyond them. And he says, behold, I will bring my servant, the branch, and then some other stuff. And then he says, and I will remove the iniquity of this land in a single day. Joshua, there's something that you point to, and one day I'm going to bring that man, and he is going to remove the iniquity of this land in a single day. In one moment, one sacrifice for all time to perfect those who are being sanctified. A prophet, a priest, a king. 2 Chronicles 17, 11 and 12. God to David, when your days are fulfilled to walk with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, one of your own sons, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for me, and I will establish his throne forever. So we see a prophet like Moses, a priest like Joshua here and the other high priests, a king like David is what we're supposed to, what the Old Testament is saying that we're supposed to expect when this gospel is finally fulfilled. We go into much more detail in the previous things, just reviewing. Okay, so the gospel is promised. The gospel is prefigured. We see this in places like Genesis 22, where God calls Abraham to sacrifice his son, but in the end, God provides the ram. that the son doesn't have to die. God provides the sacrifice. Isaiah 53, the suffering servant. We see patterns, prefigures patterns. We see, again, the priesthood, a mediator and reconciler. We see all these details of what the mediatorial work of Christ is going to be like in these patterns. We see the judges, how they're raised up to save Israel, to deliver Israel. We see King David, again, a deliverer. So we see promises, prefigures, and patterns. Then we see godliness as well. So the Old Testament tells us a lot about God. It tells us a lot about the gospel. The Old Testament tells us a lot about godliness, what it means to live a good and godly life. We see faith emphasized. This is, again, one of those ways that it touched on this a ton before, but we just don't want to see the Old Testament as something that doesn't require faith. The genuine piety of the Old Testament is Christian piety. This is why the Psalms are relevant to us. The piety of the Old Testament is Christian piety. Faith is required. Abraham is held up as an example of faith, Genesis 15. The good kings of Samuel and Kings, the kingdom prospers according to their faith, and as they are unfaithful, the kingdom goes very, very poorly. Psalms, we see this all over. 18 verse 2, the Lord is my rock, my fortress, and my deliverer, my God, my rock, in whom I take refuge, my shield, and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. Psalm 62, 1 and 2, for God alone my soul waits in silence. From him comes my salvation. This is faith. This is the godliness that the Old Testament holds out for us. We also see fear of the Lord. For an example, Psalm 128, verse 1, blessed is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways. Proverbs, a good example is Proverbs 3, 7, and 8. Be not wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord. Turn away from evil. It will be healing to your flesh and refreshment to your bones. And we see righteousness. That's your next blank. We see this in the Ten Commandments. Where are the Ten Commandments? Exodus? Yeah, 20. Very good. Deuteronomy? Yeah, that's right. Good job. Okay, Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 5. Very helpful to know which is where those are. Psalms and Proverbs all over the place. So here's how you should walk before the Lord. The prophets, Amos 5, verse 15, as an example. Hate evil and love good and establish justice in the gate. He goes on to say, it may be that the Lord, the God of hosts, will be gracious to the remnant of Joseph. And then he goes on to say that basically he despises these formal perfunctory acts of righteousness, but desires true righteousness from the heart. True righteousness from the heart, not righteousness that somehow stays in the heart. Okay. That's the Old Testament. Again, just a quick survey, quick review, quick overview. I wanted to say do that basically because the New Testament, a lot of what we're going to see in the New Testament is emphasizing, or it builds on that, right? And so there's a lot of things in, we'll touch on this here in a little bit, but the New Testament needs the Old Testament. The New Testament says, given this, here's some more that you need to know. Right, and so you need this foundation laid in the Old Testament to understand the New Testament rightly, and the New Testament is going to emphasize some of these things, underline some of these things, expand some of these things, but we can't just set it aside. Okay, intertestamental period. Just want to touch on a few details here. First is political changes. So starting with what was the kind of empire that was in charge of the Palestine at the end of the Old Testament? Anybody know? What was the world power in that part of the world then? Anyone? No. 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 So somebody said it. Yes. Is that Tony? My guy. Always got me. Persia, the Persian period. So 539 to 331 BC, this kind of overlaps with the close of the Old Testament, right? So Israel falls to Babylon. Babylon is taken by the Medes and then the Persians. Interesting story there. You can see the other side of that story if you read Herodotus. Really interesting. The Second Temple was dedicated in about 515 BC, so kind of towards the beginning of this period. Then Malachi, the last Old Testament prophet, wrote around 400 BC, so that's kind of where the Old Testament leaves off. And then you get next, what's the next period? Who's the next kind of imperial power? Greek, yes. Yeah, so Alexander conquers Israel from the Persians in 331. Alexander dies in 323. Remember, we're working down here. And then that gets divided among some of his generals. The Ptolemies rule Israel from Alexandria, Egypt. During this period, this is when the Septuagint is produced. Anybody know what that is? The Septuagint? Yeah, Greek Old Testament. Super important work there. Stellius' rule, it is brutal, 198 to 167, just brutal. Then you get the Maccabean Revolt in 167, which ends the Greek period. And then does anybody know what, well, I guess I have it written there, it's not a blank. Then you get Jewish self-rule, right? This is where the Jews ruled themselves within their own territory for about 100 years, about 100 years. You have the Maccabees and then the Hasmoneans, just family lines. Of the ruling families. And then you get the Roman period, 63 BC to about AD 70. AD 70. That's just a fun thing about the dating system. I like to mention every now and then. It's just when, whenever you see nations around the world celebrating New Year's Day, right? Celebrating, hey, now it's 2027, right? 2027 what? Anno Domini. Year of our Lord. So every time, you know, these Christ denying nations celebrate a new year, they're kind of implicitly bowing the knee to Jesus, even in a subtle way. He is truly the linchpin of history, and every calendar in the world acknowledges that. Okay, Roman period. Pompey, a general, not a town, takes Jerusalem for the Roman Republic in 63 BC. 49 BC, Julius Caesar crosses the Rubicon and takes Rome, and the empire is born. That's a dramatic story there. Julius Caesar is assassinated in 44 BC, around that time. 40 BC, Herod, who's an Edomite, is made the king of Judea by Rome. And then Augustus, there's kind of a civil war going on. Augustus defeats Mark Antony and Cleopatra, who were trying to rule from Alexandria. Augustus defeats them, reunites the empire, becomes king of the realm. Then Christ is born, interestingly, kind of around 5 BC, which is kind of curious. Dating calendar mishaps happen, so that's understandable. So we can tell this basically because we have good reason to believe, know when Herod died. So King Herod, major figure, and we kind of understand. We know that he died. We can narrow it down because we know he was at like one festival and gave a speech, and then was dead by the next one. And so it was like March, basically like between the beginning of March in 4 AD BC and the end of April that same year that Herod died, somewhere in there. And Herod is alive and well when Jesus is born, and so it's kind of he must have been born shortly before that. And then we see him die, and his son takes over, and that's why Joseph didn't want to take his family back to where they came from. So, curious little fact of history. Then Christ is crucified, AD 33. Paul converted the next year. And then Emperor Titus levels Jerusalem and the temple in the year 70. Okay, social religious changes. Interesting, you have just the context that the incarnation comes into, you have this Roman political cohesion, which is really kind of a background dominant factor for the whole New Testament, is that in all of these places that the apostles are going, that we just see happening, there's this broad-based peace of political cohesion that just kind of everybody, they're not dealing with warring tribes wherever they go. There's a huge swath of work within this political cohesion established by Rome, the Pax Romana. The Roman peace is what that means. And you also have Greek linguistic, cultural, and philosophic cohesion. The Greek culture is really interesting. It is the least historically successful culture that has been the most dominant in history. Every culture is absolutely dominated by Greek culture, and yet the Greek Empire was historically not that significant. Other than the fact that they've given us most of our language, most of our thought, most of our concepts. So incredible. So the Romans were Greek in culture. They wanted to be like their slaves. They looked at the people that they captured, subjugated, and said, "We think you're the cool guys. We kind of want to be like you." Anyway. So interesting historical. Which is why the New Testament is written in Greek, not in Latin. That was the language of the empire. Then you get, why is there basketball in here? And then you get some Jewish facts, which is interesting. So you get the Sanhedrin. That's kind of the ruling council of judges. Interesting composition, made up of the chief priests, made up of the scribes and the elders. So the chief priests, they're kind of like your aristocrats. You're kind of your Yeah, you're basically your hereditary aristocrats of the nation. Then you have your scribes. That's kind of like your expert class. They're like the lawyers. They, you know, they worked themselves up from a blue collar beginning to go to the right law school, and now they've made it big. This is your expert class. And then you have the elders, which are basically like the representatives of the people. These are the elders, the leaders of the various tribes and groups. And so it's kind of an interesting little senate there, the Sanhedrin. This is the kind of ruling council, the judges of the nation. Then you have major parties, kind of major, basically religious groups within the Jewish nation. You have the Sadducees. We see a little bit about them. They're wealthy, they're powerful, and they're basically comfortable with Rome. They're basically okay with the status quo, right? Rome is subjugating the nation, and the Sadducees are kind of like, well, things are good for us, so why make a stink? And for them, piety really centered around the temple. Centered around the temple, temple worship, temple activities. So historically, this is why when the temple is destroyed in AD 70, the Sadducee party disappears. Where the Pharisees, who we see next, is basically what becomes the only party in Judaism up to this day. Where basically this, because their emphasis was more on basically personal piety. The sect of the Pharisees, you could be a Pharisee 1,000 miles away from the temple. And so you can be a Pharisee when there is no temple. Right, all focused on basically personal piety. So the Pharisees, they're religiously strict. They oppose Roman rule, but in kind of a soft way. Soft way. And they're very loved by the people. Right, they are the people's party. Right, the Pharisees are the people that everybody looks to and goes, those are the good guys. I hope my sons grow up to be like those guys. So they're the people's party. And then there's a third party that's actually not mentioned in the Bible. Does anybody know what that is? Have you heard of it? Oh, confidence. Yes, yeah, the Essenes. So they're not mentioned in the Bible. They are a strict end times group. So they split from the Pharisees because the Pharisees were too lax. And they lived in communes in the desert. Jin. Essenes. Good question. Essenes. Good question. Yeah, they lived in a commune in the desert. They were the ones who they were reading all the prophets of the Old Testament. So interestingly, they were reading the prophets of the Old Testament and going, this is the end times. The end is here. And interestingly, like they were kind of right. They were kind of right in that Jesus is the fulfillment of these prophecies, and that the end of the epoch, the end of the era, the end of the ages, as Paul calls it, had come upon them. And they were right, but they were off in the desert building a bunker, and so they kind of missed it. So I don't know. What do you do with that? But they were the ones who preserved the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? We know about them, and we know about this because they preserved the Dead Sea Scrolls as well as some other stuff. So then we have the Zealots. They're also kind of a fourth little group in here. They're strict separatists from Rome. These guys are kind of the eager for revolt group. Like they want to, they look at Josiah, they look at David, and they go, boys, what are we doing? What are we doing? And so they are the agitators. Their big thing is the land and the law. And so then again, as the diaspora, as 70 kicks out the Jews from the land, the Zealots kind of wither away. Primarily. Okay, so those are kind of the major parties that we see interacting. We see Jesus interact with the Sadducees, with the Pharisees. Paul comes from the party of the Pharisees. We see Simon, it's called Simon the Zealot, so very likely he's a convert from this group or from this group as one of the Lord's apostles. So we just see some interesting interaction within there. Okay, key questions that we're going to address. Key questions that we're going to address. Two of them that we'll look at a little bit throughout this series is expectation versus reality and continuity versus discontinuity. So expectation versus reality, just a couple of interesting facts that we need to take into account when we look at the New Testament. So first, on the whole, especially the leading elites, the Jews did not expect Christ and did not expect him to be what he was. Did not expect him to be what he is. John 5, 39 through 40, Jesus says, you search the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life, and it is they that bear witness about me, yet you refuse to come to me that you may have life. So there was a deep interpretive problem for them. Because then the next point is that Christ says that they should have. They should have. He says, you read the Bible? I'm in it. It's about me. And you, what's the problem? There's an expectation that you're reading the scriptures wrong. Luke 24, 25, and 26, chapter 24, verses 25 and 26. And he said to them, this is after the resurrection on the road to Emmaus, Jesus says, O foolish ones and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken, was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? So again, he's saying, haven't you read about me? If you were reading your Old Testament correctly, that this should not have been surprising to you. This should not have been surprising to you. And so I draw attention to that, basically because there is a tendency, and I'm anxious that it seems to be growing in popularity, a tendency among kind of evangelical scholars and theologians to want to emphasize a so-called Jewish perspective on reading the Bible. And basically say, well, here's the Jewish perspective on this, either explicitly or implicitly saying this is the right way to read the text. This is very bad, right? This is not good. A good parallel would be like, so often you'll hear it in like, oh, this guy, he has this ministry. It's very Old Testament heavy, uses lots of Hebraic words, and you know he's legit because he studied under a rabbi. He did his PhD at some Jewish institution. I'm just like, you're the last person I want to listen to about what the Old Testament means. Honestly, it'd be like someone saying, "All right, Christians, come and learn philosophy, come and learn history, and I know my stuff because I studied under Richard Dawkins, and he's a good buddy of mine. I studied under the chief atheist of the land. I really know philosophy." No, brother, no. So we need to be. I want to just put that in front of you and just push against that trend. I think it is very dangerous. It tends towards legalism. You can see why. It tends towards legalism. Often it tends towards what I can only really describe as kind of an effeminate legalism, because often it kind of comes through this like vulnerability voice, like the Western courtroom idea is too strict and hard. So just listen to my Jewish perspective on these things. But it always tends toward legalism. It feels soft. It feels gentle. It feels like easier and a little bit more nuanced. But the gospel ends up just being like, Jesus came so that you can do better now. Jesus came to redeem the world. So do it, right? So let me name some names. And these are names and groups and things that I think I'm certainly not saying these are heretical groups, right? There are plenty of things that I could say, hey, these are just not Christian, right? Richard Rohr, we go down the list. He's just a guy out there. Your Oprah Winfrey's, they're very similar, right? Where it's just like, that's not even close, right? So these are groups that I would say, and things that I'll kind of list them in a certain order. There's fine stuff in there, and I don't think they're off limits to read, to engage with, right, that kind of thing. So I'm not saying these are all the time always inappropriate to read or engage with, but these are groups that I would say Pastor Dean puts a big yellow flag over these. Just put that in your mind of there's a piece of glass in this bowl of cereal. Just enjoy. So in order of kind of like least problematic to most problematic, right? So least problematic to most problematic. The first would be something like the Bible Project. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, where there's some good stuff in there, but there just tends to be this kind of like, you've heard it said, all Protestants for the last 500 years have said, but I say to you. So there's helpful stuff in there, but I would yellow flag that for sure. And then has anybody heard of the Bema podcast or the Bema podcast? So that would kind of be another one kind of on that list. Again, it's kind of the like, hey, here's the Jewish perspective on this, and that trumps all Protestant doctrine for the last 500 years. Yellow flag. The next one would be someone named N.T. Wright. Anybody know him? So he's, if you're like doing really serious scholarly research, like he's useful in that context. But again, just kind of tends towards this like, his doctrine is this idea of covenantal gnomism. Basically, you're saved by grace and you stay in through works. Big yellow flag. And then last would be a guy named John Mark Comer. Am I familiar with him? He's recently, you know, he denies the atonement, like recently came out and denied penal substitutionary atonement. So these are kind of that, like, that they lean toward this. Let's read the Bible from the Jewish perspective because that's better. And Jesus is saying, no, the Jewish perspective missed Christ. The Jewish perspective crucified Christ. We need to understand that. So there's some expectation versus reality that we should bring into our consideration of the New Testament. Continuity and discontinuity, the next one. Ooh, running out of time. Continuity, Romans 12, 17 through 18. So basically the idea of how does the New Testament relate to the Old Testament? We need to grapple correctly with both the continuity and the discontinuity. So you can read these verses on your own time. I guess the blanks, I would say Romans 12 kind of pushes towards this idea of like continue and purify. As the Old Testament covenant community is this tree that then some branches were cut off and now you're grafted in. Same thing, but pure, right? There's a continuity. And then discontinuity, Hebrews 8, 6, and 7. Christ's ministry is better. Christ's covenant is better. So there's this hard, this like this replacement idea of the new covenant replaces the old covenant. So there's discontinuity there. And so we need to do justice to both. So what I would say there is the New Testament is not, and this is interesting how even the early church recognized this just in what we do with the scriptures. The New Testament is not just another part of the same thing. Right, so when the Psalms were written, when Isaiah was written, they're just kind of like, all right, this just kind of becomes the next chapter of this thing of that we call our scriptures. The church recognized these new scriptures are different. It's a new testament. There's something different here. And yet, the New Testament does not totally replace the Old Testament. It's not, all right, we're done with this, throw it away, now we have this. Right, so that just even how we hold, we have two testaments, two distinct testaments that we hold together. One Bible, two testaments. Distinct but inseparable. There's a tension there that we need to wrestle with. Okay, quickly, structure of the New Testament, history, doctrine, prophecy. So history, Matthew through Acts, doctrine, Romans through Jude, prophecy, Revelation. I don't need to go into the codex stuff. This is kind of a little bit of history about manuscript stuff. Major events, the birth of Christ to the ascension of Christ is kind of one epoch of the New Testament. And we'll talk about that in weeks to come. Then you have the ascension of Christ to the destruction of Jerusalem, another kind of that apostolic period, and then the destruction of Jerusalem to the final return of Christ, which is the period that we are in, kind of being the major events of the New Testament. Okay, then big ideas. The three blanks are Christ, Kingdom, Commission. Christ, Kingdom, Commission. We'll see these are some of the major themes that we will see in the New Testament, again, while also reaffirming those Old Testament themes, right? Still building on God, gospel, and godliness, but now we add Christ, kingdom, and commission. So we'll see who Christ is, his identity, his nature, his character. We'll see, we'll learn about his kingdom, the extent of it, the character of it, what it's like, and we'll learn about the church's commission, our mission, our power, and the promises attached to it. Okay. Better than I thought. So that's all I have for you today. Hope this is exciting for the coming weeks and months. I'm excited. Let me pray for you, and then we'll be done.